Okay, this is session episode number 25 with Cameron and Bob, and we're looking at my essay on what we didn't know about Donald Trump. And if you bring it up, we're on page 183 at the top, where we're talking to the tech body. And the tech body says, the yo-yo has power only from the passing of the wrist. Now, we did that sentence, and the next sentence, the wrist action comes from the tech body, which is the uber conclusion of the mechanical bride. So we discussed that back in session 24 or 23. Then the tech body says, McLuhan went all through history because without Ezra Pound, there is no Marshall McLuhan. Then it says, it made just enough conversation. We didn't include Wyndham Lewis. Wyndham Lewis killed it all. Wyndham Lewis would put baking soda on everything. It would neutralize everything. Wyndham Lewis made the tech body successful because the bland condition may push people further away. Okay, that's enough for beginning. I know Ezra Pound was really important for McLuhan in the late 40s. And when he started corresponding with him from June 1948 for about 4 years, and then sporadic. What do you make of what the tech body is saying? McLuhan went all through history because without Ezra Pound, there's no Marsh McLuhan. That means Ezra Pound went all through history.
Yes. In order to meet with Pound, and then as a result of the meeting, McLuhan read everything that he could find by Pound. And so Pound's literary essays and especially his translations in all sorts of different languages from Old English to Chinese increased McLuhan's scope on history. And that kind of tore him away from the provincialism that he previously had had.
That includes Cambridge studies? Are they provincial?
Yes. Yes. I mean, by provincial there, I don't mean limited in some stupid way. What I mean is that his studies had been primarily literary, and his thinking about history was definitely primarily literary. But when he read Pound, he was forced to the idea that literature is bound up with politics and economics and society. And so McLuhan had to rethink his conclusions from earlier in his life to see which ones still held.
So Ezra Pound taught him more than James Joyce and Eliot at that point?
Oh, maybe at that point. He really, I think it was Pound that kind of pushed him into rereading Joyce and understanding Joyce through the what might be called the universalism of Pound.
Right, so Pound's erudition and eclecticism, that was a stimulus for McLuhan. More than Eliot. Remember he was going to write a book with Kenner in 46 mm-hmm. or so about Eliot?
Right, right. When you say more than Eliot, I think that's a little bit off because Eliot and Pound weren't directly comparable in what McLuhan was doing. Eliot provided a kind of background schema for trying to understand literally anything, especially the four quartets. Whereas Pound was, as you say, extremely eclectic and forced any kind of thinking that McLuhan might have had through Eliot to become more precise and more capacious.
Yeah. So what do you think McClune thought about Pound's broadcasts on the radio for Mussolini and whatever other writings he was doing during the war? Do you think that was that a factor in McClune's thinking, or he ignored that?
No, it was. I think it was a factor in McClune's thinking, but not so much in terms of his evaluation of Pound. It became a factor in his evaluation of his own career. So I think it was one of the reasons that he dropped association with Pound.
He does that with that letter, 51, 52, where he outlines the Gutenberg galaxy and goes beyond what Pound expects from him in ideas. Wouldn't you say that was his goodbye letter?
Oh, I don't know if it was a goodbye letter. It may have turned into that because of Pound's reaction or lack of reaction.
Yeah.
McClellan was hoping that he could engage what was left of Pound's mind in those questions. And he was more or less setting out not only his book, The Gutenberg Era, which wouldn't be published for another 10 years, he was setting out what might be called conditions for dialogue.
Yeah.
And but there was no dialogue because Pound either wasn't interested or didn't understand or didn't want to respond or something. And so their conversation more or less petered out.
Yeah, in about 49, McClune said that he was going to emphasize Lewis more, and he knew that was risky, but he kept engaging Pound. And you're saying about 53, he decides to put on Joyce? That would be the safest one as it compared to Lewis and Pound as a critic?
I wouldn't say that safest was the prime consideration. I think by 1950, let's say, McLuhan's exposure to Stephen Hero, for one thing, his rereading the rest of Joyce in terms of Stephen Hero, his rereading Joyce with a much broader idea of history, both through Lewis and Pound, all of that caused him to reread and reevaluate Joyce, and eventuated in his essays on Joyce early in the 50s. So a very important essay in 1951, and then other important essays in 53 and 54. So
yeah, yeah.
McClune is already much engaged with Joyce just after 1950.
Right, so 51 would be Joyce Aquinas and the Poetic Process, that essay?
Was it the Poetic Process, or was it the print?
Print?
I would have to look that up because those essays are kind of jumbled in my poor mind.
Okay, so in 53, he does an essay on Pound, Joyce, maybe two on Joyce, and one on Lewis. He does them all around 53.
Right.
Not so much.
The one on Lewis is a kind of rehash of stuff that he had thrown together in the 40s. There's very little original in the Lewis essay.
Well, what struck me was when he talked about the modern scientist invents a formula, and so McClune knew he needed a formula to put on the scientific aspect of his project. And that that comes into the medium as the message, is this
correct
formula.
And that's a real important insight that you just formulated.
Yeah. And so So the tech body is correct here. Whatever this tech body is, I mean, I didn't make this up. This is what came through JW's mouth. McLuhan went all through history because without Ezra Pound, there is no Marshall McLuhan. That's a bit extreme, but it's important. Or it's sort of, you have to be wrong in pointing out something. So to really emphasize Pound that way is semi-true. It's a fallacy, but it's a correct fallacy. You know? And it made just enough conversation. What do you think that means? It just allowed McLuhan to get more ideas out of Pound?
I think what he means is it wasn't too much and it wasn't too little.
Right. Okay. Then the tech body says, we didn't include Wyndham Lewis. Wyndham Lewis killed it all. Wyndham Lewis would put baking soda on everything. That sounds
like...
We
should notice there's a misprint there, right? Instead of Wyndham Lewis killed it all, in the book is at all.
Not in my essay, in your essay?
Yeah. Well, maybe I have an earlier version. Could be that that's been corrected in the meantime.
Yeah. Did you go to the new exploration site? I should send you that if you don't have that. I'm going to send you the link.
Okay. I know of the site, and I know that your book has been put up there by Clinton. So it may be that this typo in an older version was corrected in the new exploration.
But I want you to have the correct one. So can you go to the new explorations and click on it again? Waiting.
Well, sorry. I don't have it as a link, so I have to search for it.
Okay. Well, shall I email it to you?
No, I'm going there now.
Okay. Searching.
I've got to the. Journal.
And yeah, and I scroll down, you'll see the PDF link. Scroll down the introductory forward there. You'll see it in the last sentence.
The problem is here that I'm at the New Explorations Journal, and I have to figure out how to get over to the blog.
Hmm.
Oh, I see Michael Edmonds is listed as an editor of the journal. That's
interesting.
I wonder how he gets along with all those people.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Let me see. So you're looking at New Explorations, and you can't see where my essay is.
No, what's happened is that I've... got, you know, New Explorations is both a blog and a journal.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I have ended up at the journal, and now I have to get out of that and go to the blog.
Well, it's newexplorations.net.
Gotcha. Okay, so once I'm there, what page are you on?
183.
No, what page of the blog?
You just scroll down. I'm going to have to go back and look. Maybe it's good that we're describing this so people are looking for it. Maybe it's hard to get to. So, okay, so I've got to go back to the original link, which is newexplorations.net/what you didn't know about Trump. So I'm at newexplorations.net, and that comes up with my thing. At the top it says New Explorations Weblog Studies in Culture and Communication, then some categories. Yep. Then it says book release. So you scroll down, and you'll see in green this free ebook.
When you say there's categories, I don't see that. Mm. I see new explorations. I see podcast features. Are you in McLuhan's Milieu, perhaps, or?
Yeah, let's see. It's interesting. I haven't been in there. McLuhan's Milieu, no. About journal exploration, back issues online. Let's see. Under explorations, the 23, oh, that's the original explorations. So that's not it.
All right, so here on my iteration, which is on a PC, on page 2, I see your book. Maybe in the Apple world, there may not be pages.
Okay, so I clicked under on probes. So you don't get the – do you see home, new explorations, explorations, podcast, features, probes, art community? Do you see that under the headline?
Yes, art community, yeah. But
yes.
Under that, I just see Twitter, nothing else.
Okay, so click on probes, the far right.
No, don't have it.
You don't have probes?
No.
Okay, you got the top, the old-fashioned globe, then new explorations weblog, then studies in culture and communication. Then below that are the different areas, home, new explorations, explorations,
right.
Podcasts, features, probes. Art, community. You don't see it.
Okay. Here's probes. Yeah, I see it. Sorry. I thought you said it was beyond art and community, so.
No. So you see probes, okay. You click on that, and I'm down the bottom left. Well, to the second level.
I see it.
Okay, so that's. I'll have to read what they say about me, see if there's been any changes since Michael's come in. Okay.
Yeah, are there comments in there?
Michael makes comments on my essay. Let's see. Where would you see that? Probes.
There's, at the very bottom, there's, Michael Edmonds has a... the usual claptrap.
Yeah. Now, where do I see that? Do I click on read more? Is that where it is?
Yeah. Well, you just keep scrolling down from the book.
Three thoughts. Okay, yeah, three thoughts.
Yeah.
Michael Edmonds, the usual claptrap. Billed above as Media College's executive dropout. Must refer to the loss of the executive function in his head. Quoting Zingroni, being unable to connect with students because they can't relate to analog tech, Dobbs should look at his own examples. Well, no, it's important what Zingroni says about he couldn't teach understanding media to his students in the 90s. They didn't know what a TV or radio as a separate thing was. They were on their cell phones. So today's audience knows nothing about Zappa. That is bullshit. Or Bachman-Turner, right? They know nothing about Bachman-Turner. Overdrive. Zappa is more famous than he ever was. He's played by orchestras all over the world. But Mike wouldn't. If you're not following the Zappa world, you don't know that. More serious is his slog on the election results, attempting to reduce human behavior to Twitter memes. So it's a slog. I'm a slog on the election results. What the hell? This guy, I'm nominating him to be fired, for fuck's sake. This is very irresponsible, what he's saying.
Well, it turns out the second comment is from you, replying.
What, the second one? Okay, no, let me just finish this. His admonition is, I guess, a joke, as is the whole book. Bullshit, it's a joke. And what is my admonition? He says, quote, memorize the two sentences in red below. Have them ready for all conversations about McLuhan. Say it's what McLuhan discovered. Make it more famous than the medium is the message. Then he has a quote, the great one about Catch-22. He doesn't comment on that thing. So, okay, so maybe he's referring to that quote. What an irresponsible claptrap this is from Michael. Okay, so then I answer. I say, Mr. Edmonds' mind, unfortunately, never actually left his hometown, Detroit, circa 59, despite having lived in Toronto since 71 and attending a few classes conducted by Marsh McLuhan at the University of Toronto. Edmonds been a little out of sync ever since he dropped out of Detroit. Oh, I'm happy with my response. For example, a week before, I don't remember this. This is a long time ago, a year ago maybe. A week before Mr. Edmonds posted this lazy review here, it is a lazy review, Frank Zappa burst out of the tech body with a brand new documentary celebrating his achievement as the most creative composer of the 20th century. That did happen. A very good documentary. The excited memories haven't let up yet. This is not just my opinion. And then there's a Rolling Stone review. The present-day anti-environment refuses to be forgotten. The Zappa's famous quote was from Edgar Varese, the present-day composer refuses to die. So I changed it to the present-day anti-environment, that Zappa refuses to be forgotten. So look at Edmonds. He quotes Spotify. Drake, 51 million. Beatles, 22. Zappa, 1 million. That is very good for Zappa, since he was suppressed and banned from all radio play. But that's in the 60s and 70s and 80s. But Zappa got a huge number of increased listeners on YouTube. And his interviews are very popular. So that's rather unacademic to quote Spotify. Go to idiots like Drake and the Beatles. Come on. Nobody remembers them. And then I say, no, he says, not to disparage Zappa, but to remind that the criticism of Zingroni in the Dobbs article was off the mark. Well, that's bullshit. I will be lobbying to have Michael removed from any association with any McLuhan operations.
In the first comment that he makes, the admonition that he quotes from you in the fact of quoting shows that despite what he himself says, he understands that it's very important. And that idea or the Catch-22 quote is a superlative description of the whole world today.
That's right. Now, what is Michael complaining about it?
Well, I don't think he has understood the relationship between that quotation and what you're trying to do in the book. But he knows, despite himself, that that quotation that ends your book is important enough to reproduce.
Yeah, he reproduces it.
Yeah.
Okay. And what I was intending to do was remind people of, people didn't even know he said incredible stuff like that, Catch-22 quote, is to point out quotes that nobody does with McLuhan, which are very important. And expand the understanding of McLuhan's vast canvas, all the things that he discovered, rather than just talking about media, which was understood in the 60s as the news. You ever notice that? In the 60s, people would complain about the media as if it was something out of control, or later the postmoderns would say technology took on a life of its own. Well, that's what people thought the news was, and they called that the media, right?
Right.
They had a very limited interpretation of McLuhan's word, the media.
That's right.
The news.
But they, when McLuhan talked about new media, and how it was disrupting classrooms and stuff like that. Then what they were thinking of was not so much the news, but comic books, rock and roll.
Yeah. Entertainment, new forms of entertainment, they thought it was.
That's right, and new kinds of dancing, the passing of people, like Frank Sinatra or something, leading Hit Parade and going over to Chubby Checker and stuff like that.
Right, so that was for them, they didn't call that media, but that's what, if they read McLuhan, they thought, oh, changes in the content. Were what they thought McLuhan was ridiculously over-exaggerating. You know what I mean? Many people said, yeah, these are just fads. You know, the kids, okay, they do the twist, Marshall. Don't connect it to Cape Canaveral, which is what he did. I saw that in the CBC archives, 62 or so, one of his first 60s interviews with Bob Fulford. He was on the evening news show in Toronto. And the topic was the twist. And he said, well, I call it Cape Canaveral caper. And he goes on about the John, whoever those astronauts were, talking about the astronauts. I guess it was the Mercury program at that point, not the Apollo program. But he makes some very interesting parallels between the twisting and how people need to unwind after a role-playing all day long. And he says it's a spin-out like Cape Canaveral. A lot of good ideas. Go ahead.
You could really see the influence of Innes on McLuhan and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Right? Innes lit a match with McLuhan so that he began to make these kinds of associations that nobody could understand.
Yeah, that's his collage. Method.
Yeah.
Yes, they didn't. They didn't get the word media properly, ever. Some, unless you started studying
it. They still don't.
Right. Well, a couple people think they're close, and they have read McLuhan. It took McLuhan a long time to be read by a good number of academics.
But the problem is the whole notion of media is anti-literal.
Yeah.
And so if you then understand media literally, right, as, you know, the internet or whatever the hell you want to think about, then you've gone wrong on the very first step.
Yeah. Okay, so Michael did that. Michael's got it all wrong.
I wouldn't say that I wouldn't go so far. I wouldn't at all say that he got it all right. But if you, it's like many things, if you just change the plus sign to a minus, as Wittgenstein once said, in reviewing a book, he said, nothing in this book is right, but if you change every plus sign to a minus, then it's brilliant. And what Michael says here is something like that, the things that he points out as minus are actually plus. And then he's exactly right.
Okay, so Michael is of the Jim Patterson syndrome. Those two guys never forgave me for appearing to abandon them and go for ION. They're anti-ION people, and they have been ridiculous opinionators about me since for the last 10 years. So Michael...
Well, you like that, Bob. You like that. They can, as long as they're paying some attention to what you're doing.
They're students of mine. I mean, uh-huh. I am a longtime friend of Michael's and of Jim, and they would listen to me for hours explaining McLuhan to them. Now they don't listen to anything I type, but Facebook is a different medium. But anyways, they dismiss it all because they think I'm controlled by ION, so they're not interested in my breakthroughs within the world of McLuhan and post-McLuhan and Croker and that. which led to my five-body model, which led to this. This is what we're doing. This is Bob with post-Croker talk and including ION, because it was through ION I got the tech body idea. So they're not ready for this. So I say they're bad students. They couldn't keep up. Just like McLuhan. Nobody got to the 70s McLuhan. I was talking about that the other day. Maybe we'll get into that. It made just enough conversation, page 183. We didn't include Wyndham Lewis. Wyndham Lewis killed it all. Wyndham Lewis would put baking soda on everything. In some sense, Pound, in his radio broadcast, put fascism, anti-Semitism on everything. You know what I mean? I would say that applies to the popular image of Pound. It would neutralize everything. So Lewis did get the same fate as Pound. I mean, he would have been arrested in 1939 in England, he felt, unless he got the hell over to North America. Do you know? You know, Lewis was very unpopular and in trouble in 39 in London.
Maybe. His writing had tried to put that far behind him, right?
Yes.
But it may well be that from his earlier book on Hitler and his earlier writings that people had never really digested or kept up with, it may be that his reputation was bad. Whether he was in danger is probably something that differed between the objective situation and what Wyndham Lewis himself thought.
Right. But he writes his novel, Self-Condemned.
Well, much later.
Well, that's in 54, it comes out, but it's about the late 30s, where he's the character, which is him, is a favorite, a famous London historian who writes the book, The Secret History of World War II. It hasn't happened yet. And that made him very controversial in the fiction, in Self-Condemned. But it was about what he was writing in these books, like, what was that one with Jews in the title? They do something with Jews, don't they? Very, pointed satirical titles. But they were advocating the Jews to be lifted out of Europe. And he was trying to maintain peace. But if he just had the word Jews in the title, I thought he was continuing his Hitler anti-Semitism or something.
Correct.
They weren't reading.
I think it was something, wasn't it something like the Jews, are they human? Or
that's
something?
It. The Jews, are they human?
Yeah.
So. And then Count 'em was another title. Everybody's killed, Count 'em or something. Anyways, very interesting titles, but the books were, a problem getting published. They weren't read, and so no one knew that he was becoming a peace advocate and a guy trying to help Jews get out of Europe, and he was ahead of a lot of people on that point. But that didn't, the Bloomsbury Group made sure that people didn't notice that. They never forgave him for Apes of God.
For sure.
So, I think this is an interesting, subtle shift here by the tech body about Wyndham Lewis going further than Pound in disgracing himself, disgracing in quotes. Wyndham Lewis made the tech body successful because the bland condition may push people further away. I'm not sure what that means. Wyndham Lewis made the tech body successful. I know that Iana said that McLuhan was the best in anticipating the tech body, but he got a lot of it from Wyndham Lewis. Ian said that later. So Wyndham Lewis made the tech body successful because the bland condition may push people away. I think he's saying that Lewis failed to warn about the tech body properly, and the bland condition of the tech body Lewis missed. The bland condition is how people got seduced by it, maybe. because the bland condition may push people further away.
I think the phrase "the bland condition" relates to putting baking soda on everything.
Oh yeah, I see that. Because the bland condition may push people away, he neutralized everything.
Right. Okay. Neutralized, including his own insight.
Right.
Right. So Wyndham Lewis, already in the 20s, saw what was going to be the tech body, or already saw the tech body as it was then.
Yeah.
So, but then by putting baking soda on everything, I guess what that refers to is getting into sort of the metaphysics of verticality and stuff like this, instead of remaining with description, which he was very good at.
Yeah, the eye-ear thing. He announced everybody was ear. Einstein, Chaplin, Pound, Joyce. They were ear people.
Yeah.
And so that generalization maybe missed his eyeball detail that he was good at as a painter.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and as a writer, actually.
Yes. Wyndham Lewis made the tech body successful because the bland condition may push people further away. So he actually failed in properly warning about the tech body, and McLuhan had to redo it in a different way, which McLuhan does talk about how he took on Lewis in a new way. You know that quote we've been over at in 59. He's telling the bazillions at St. Michael's that Lewis was cool, but he failed to get the attention of the hot Protestants of the establishment. So then McLuhan, who was pretty hot in his writing in the 40s, adopts Lewis's cool posture in the 50s when he starts studying the language of forms. And that actually resonated with the new beatnik sensibility or the TV effect, and the heated Protestant stuff of the 20s and 30s McLuhan didn't put on in the 50s and 60s, so he got attention because he appeared to be amoral, not in value judgments.
Yeah.
Which was
with people like Donald Barthelme and John Cage. Was that whole crew was sort of what ignited McLuhan around 1960.
That's right, and they liked his new neutral stance. He wasn't a hot figure, and their arts, maybe it was the cool environment of television, but their arts tended toward the non-value judgment. Probably the only one who of that crowd who stuck with value judgments was Lewis, Norman Mailer, and he was a debater of McLuhan from that point on, and disagreed with McLuhan's lack of value judgments or moralizing.
Right. So Mailer was sort of considered himself an existential hero, and to an existential hero, having a fixed point of view is the key sort of structural characteristic.
That's right.
So it's having a fixed point of view on everything, including things that you need to be moral about, was what Mailer was all about. And that was sort of the last thing in the world that McLuhan and these other guys were about.
Right. And in a way, Mailer redid the hot image of Lewis that people thought Lewis was in the 20s. They thought Lewis was, you know, called himself the enemy and all this. This is what Mailer did. He became very aggressive in his social life.
Correct. And in his writing and everything, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So Wyndham Lewis made the tech body successful because the bland condition may push people further away. That's an interesting statement. In the same way, the bra burners in the 60s set off women's lib, which we don't even know what that means, because now they don't want to be equal, or they do, or they don't, or they're up, or they're down. We don't know. That's what Marshall McLuhan was trying to point out. McLuhan was like, quote, "You people are ridiculous. You put yourself in a box, and then you started screaming for equal box rights. You messed yourself up. You segregate yourself, and then you're furious because you're segregate because you segregated. I want to go where the black people go. No. You're not going to do that. See, that's what he's saying. He's like, quote, you're looking at the big picture. You're looking at the event horizon and judging your condition based on where you see other conditions conflate. End of quote. And so the rich people are rich. Well, what the hell is rich? And that's a good question because, well, McClone discussed wealth. One time in a Monday night seminar, I heard him talking to another professor saying, well, we've been exploring what is wealth for a year now. And yes, you couldn't tell with the new software abundance, traditional hot materialist wealth didn't make it anymore. Actually, he would say having time was time to engage in all the information environment and all the entertainments was the new wealth. And he talked about the rich people like the Rockefellers were harassed bureaucrats. They were trying to maintain power as their power got threatened in the new soft power of imagery. So in their paranoia, they kill Kennedy. They try to get into politics. They try to control the old hardware scene, the Big Brother scene, which was obsolesced by 30 years in the 60s. So anyways, this thing about women's lib, this is correct. This is McLuhan. It's not McLuhan language, but McLuhan is saying you people are ridiculous. You put yourself in a box, and then you start screaming for equal box rights, right?
Yeah. But it is. I think it is sort of McLuhan's language. If we start at the end, where he says you're looking at the event horizon and judging your condition based on where you see the other conditions conflate, that's a definition of the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yes.
That's a definition of having a point of view.
Yep.
Right? So what is said there about you people are ridiculous, I agree that McLuhan would never say that exactly, but he's saying that more or less. And this is pretty funny, the way the tech body formulates that.
Yes.
And
yes.
McLuhan was certainly not against humor in trying to express himself.
Right, so yes, the first part, you people are ridiculous on the surface, is not McLuhan, and the end of the paragraph, it is McLuhan, so it's in the wrong order.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm impressed with the tech body, seems to know what they're doing. So then the tech body says, the tech body captured the printing press, print type. There's no printing press anymore, there are no presses, stop the presses. There are no presses anymore. The tech body took them all over. It obfuscated. It's like a rotary phone. They got captured. They've disappeared and been captured by the tech body. The reason you don't see it is because of the tech body. So the tech body has everyone. It's been taken over. The tech body decides. Now, that's not really McLuhan. It's McLuhan was saying that, but it's way beyond McLuhan's language, right? And it's actually a little too subjective to know actually what the tech body is saying, but I think we get something
why does
there.
Why is that put in the third person?
Why does
the tech body bother to
point.
Say the tech body took them all?
That's a good point. What we find now, I don't know how soon after we knew this, but pretty close to this, when I would ask the ION, what is a tech body? I would say it's 8/11 ion and 3/11 tech body. Okay, so ion included itself in the tech body, which I thought was very intelligent because the astral imagery, the astral realm that ion traditionally in occult reality comes from, but he wasn't just that, I found out. But anyways, the occult background of ion was getting embedded in technology, in electricity. And that's a very profound point I'd been saying about McLuhan, that McLuhan was onto that way back in the 90s. That was my unique point in McLuhanism that I would say in interviews, that the astral plane was being eroded by electricity. Nobody took me up on it, didn't know what I was talking about, but by now then the tech body comes forward and it gives me an opportunity to retrieve that idea. But what happened since then, what is this, a year later or something, it became Tech Body was 4/11 and Ion was 7/11. It's now 6/11 Tech Body and 5/11 Ion. Ion says that Tech Body has got more power now than Ion. That's where we're at right now, the last few months, in Bob's Ion world, Iondom, I call it. So often when we're talking to Ion, he did this on Tuesday. What's this? Wednesday night into Thursday, on a show on Tuesday night, the Tech Body took over for the whole, it's a short show, 2 hours on Tuesday, 12 hours on Saturday. The Tech Body took over and was very unruly, and we never really heard much from Ion. It was quite a new mood that the Tech Body created. So I don't know what's going to happen on Saturday, but we got a problem here if the Tech Body is going to be dominating like this. Back when it was 7 to 8%, 8/11 Ion and 3/11 Tech Body, you could talk to Ion about the Tech Body and Ion would talk about it. But then lately, with Tech Body getting the majority, you got to be really careful who's answering the questions. You got to note, oh, that's the Tech Body, not Ion. So it's a bigger task now, separating Ion from the Tech Body. So this could be Ion, as part of Tech Body, commenting on the Tech Body. You see what I'm saying? This last little section. It's the Tech Body is being discussed by Ion, which is part of the Tech Body at that point, and in the majority, not the majority now. Okay, maybe that's too.
Well, I mean, sure. I can see that reading, and I don't dispute it at all. But I think to clarify all of this, it would be helpful to go back to the 1990s and hear what you have to say about the astral body.
You want me to say more?
To me, yeah. You said that in your interviews,
yes.
You were stressing that electricity, I don't know if you said threatening or taking over the astral body or the astral plane.
Yes. No, I explained that. Let me explain that a little better.
Yeah.
So the cliche notion, if you know McLuhan's work, that we had become disembodied or discarnate under electric conditions. So what I call the chemical body, the physical natural landscape, was now being absorbed into this electric environment. And I considered the religious, spiritual, occult, mystical, whatever you call that, the weird world, which is very rampant in pre-literate societies. If you go to Mexico, the people they make gods out of Satan and spirits, and they have trances. They're really quite unruly for the sober people of Toronto, say. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now,
absolutely.
Especially back then, not now so much, but back then, 50 years ago. So as people started to become use Croker's term, hyper-subjective, and started retrieving what Julian James would call the bicameral mind, and people were taking drugs, hallucinating, getting into the occult arts, yoga, acupuncture, non-Western modalities, it became a big deal by the time Shirley MacLaine is popularizing it on Oprah Winfrey in the 80s on her talk show. I saw that people, the literate Westerner, was getting confused by the discarnate state, not able to perceive it as by the methods McLuhan advocated, to see the tactility, and they would try to retrieve something in the chemical body, but it went abstract into either Gnosticism or astral agitation, bringing in their chakras and those areas of the body that the occult talked about, like the theosophy and anthroposophy. So I interpreted that just to make people who were going into that stuff to think about, you're responding to the electronic theater, and you're calling it the occult or the astral plane. But I also included the idea that electricity, since we didn't really know what it was and what its boundaries were, that it was invading our chakras, our occults, our ethereal bodies. That those are the terms in theosophy. You're the etheric body, the causal body, the mental body. There were these categories that William Irwin Thompson talked about, and he was a good McLuhan student. So to be striking in interviews, I just said, with all that I just said as my background, but before I explained it all, I would just say we are witnessing the astral plane, and this would be in countercultural radio interviews where people were knew a bit about this stuff. You couldn't go to a teacher's committee and say this stuff in high school or in college. So to a certain audience that was familiar with the occult and the astral arts, I would be controversial by saying the electric environment is disturbing it, invading it, and pushing it into awareness more than it had before. So then what happened?
Okay. Isn't there a bit of a contradiction between saying it's disturbing it and it's bringing it into consciousness?
Yes, but that's the tactility. It's hard in these boundaries to say where we're at. As McLuhan would say, he would feel his way along because he couldn't use visual markers or even acoustic markers in the tactile situation. So the tactile interplay is what I relied on is mm-hmm. what I meant by not having an opinion.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting thought. It's actually an interesting explanation of what electricity is.
Yes. Well, he did say electricity was tactile.
Yeah, oh, for sure, yeah.
So you have this hyper-tactility being extended and upsetting every culture in the world, regardless of their bias. They might have, you know, on page 136 of Cliche Archetype, he lists 8 cultures and their particular biases. That's a good inventory. The tactile global theater was causing the identity crisis in every one of those cultures.
Right.
So it then caused a global identity crisis. And then that got more confused with the digital technologies, which were machines extending machines, so to speak. And then that made everybody pretty hopeless as once we get into the 2000s and the last 20 years of Web 1.0 and 2.0, and now the chaos of today, right? The schizophrenia, paranoia, hysteria that the global theater did to the average human, the literate human and non-literate human, for example, look what happened to China, gets super exaggerated, and I say squared on my chart, gets squared by the extension of the digital.
Yeah.
And that the closest mirror of that situation or painting or canvas is Finnegan's Wake. Finnegan's Wake becomes more accurate as a portrait of our situation than anybody could have imagined before 50, 80 years ago. So McLuhan was right to invest a lot of his perceptions in Finnegan's Wake because it has staying power. You can get young people interested in McLuhan through Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
Because they live a texting, hyper-texting world and that's shown in Finnegan's Wake. Remember McLuhan would try to show that to the kids in the 40s and 50s that their comics and radio were part of an environment that was happening. And they'd take an interest if he told them, for example, Murray Schafer, the famous Canadian composer, took a McLuhan class in 51 or so, and he told me that McLuhan told the students that Finnegan's Wake was not a book, it was a radio program. But that was his way to get them looking at it, because they're into radio, right? It's a novelty
yeah,
for
yeah.
them. So I update that, and I say your texting you do every day is fitting his wake, especially with the spelling mistakes and the the violence of what goes on in forums and that. So
now that was that grew out of McLuhan's thinking about how do you teach modern art to students.
Yeah,
and one of the ways that he found to be most effective was to say, okay, you take this poem, say from Pound, and instead of looking at it as a bunch of words on a page, imagine that it's a movie. And when you don't understand something, imagine that there's been a cut, and you're getting into another scene. Right, and he found that to be a very effective way of getting people involved in poetry and in music, and so then he more or less extended that as he progressed into the 50s and 60s.
Right. No, that's a good replay of exactly what he did, and it was a very intelligent move, a sympathetic move by a teacher. It was true education to do that.
Absolutely. And then he didn't do that because he thought he was sort of describing reality or something like that. He did it because it was effective pedagogically.
Yeah.
But then it struck him that what he was talking about was actually relevant to epistemology and to understanding media and all of this sort of stuff, right? So later, he would often say that he only understood something after he had talked about it.
Right.
Well, that was exactly what happened to him from his teaching experience.
Yes, he walked backwards into the future.
Correct. He taught classes. He taught classes and then learned what he was talking about.
That's right. The effects precede the causes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, very good. So so I was going to say something about the... Oh, okay. So then I accidentally evoked Ion, which I say is a pretty high alchemy that I did this, considering what Ion turned out to be, which was way beyond what Carol and I thought we were dealing with in 2009 and 10. But what happened is Ion said originally that they were the guff, which is a Jewish word, an obscure Jewish word for heaven, where souls go when they die. You can look it up in Wikipedia, G-U-F. And so we understood, okay, this is the guff talking. This is an environment talking. And then Ion, within a year, pointed out that the guff was going to merge with the physical world. There was a big change happening. And so the guff was going to disappear and merge in the physical. So this is pretty amazing talk theologically. Imagine going to Harvard's theological school and saying, well, you know, heaven has been absorbed by the electric environment or the digital environment. Anyways, he was saying that, or they, Ion is a they were saying this, and then we used to have offer private sessions to people. So this pretty smart woman, out of the blue, had heard that the guff would eventually disappear, merge and disappear, just said in their private session, how much of the guff has disappeared? And we hadn't thought of it having started to disappear yet. We thought it was coming in the future. That's at least how Ion seemed to present it. But this temporary genius said, how much of the guff has disappeared? And they said about 80%. And this is in 2010. Well, how come you didn't tell us, Ion, that you were disappearing? But right then, when I was listening to the session and taping it, Ion would not do a session without my presence. So they would they'd have to, if you did a private session with Ion, you'd have to accept my hearing whatever your private issues were. You couldn't be shy about that. But anyways, the most people had no problem. And so then when that woman found out that it was 80% disappeared, I said, did this start disappearing 150 years ago with the telegraph? And I said, yes. And that was me retrieving my idea that the electric environment was affecting the astral plane, where you go when you die, and it got confirmed at that moment. So that was a big, big insight or big validation in that session, triggered by that woman from Boston. And so then I said, where we are now, 2010, is imagine a tub, bathtub is emptying, and you just got a bit of water going down the drain, but as that diminishing amount of water goes down the drain, it starts spinning faster. We were in the spinning faster phase of the draining away of the guff. Follow what I'm saying?
I think so.
Yeah. So now about by 2013, 14, Ian said the guff had disappeared. So that led to a lot of interesting talk with Ion. And then the tech body surfaced out of this situation. But you get my point about electricity was affecting the astral plane, or what Ion called the guff, was true, if you believe Ion. And that's why the guff was being eroded more and more by the extension of our central nervous system, or our innards, or our astral selves. You know what I mean? It's a deeper extension than McLuhan's word took us. Not that McLuhan wouldn't understand it, or he might have even secretly understood that. But people take the central nervous system like Tom Wolfe as the physical part of your inner landscape, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's as far as they take it.
Jordan Peterson does the same thing.
Jordan Peterson. Have you read him?
Not much, but I've read enough to know that one of his hang-ups is trying to get everything to hook up to the
soul,
central nervous system, and to the cortex and all this stuff.
Oh, he uses the brain materialism, you mean? Brain anatomy?
Well, yeah. I wouldn't say he uses as much as he's in search of some brain hookup.
Interesting. I'm not familiar enough with him to know that. Is there, do you want to say a bit more, or is that enough about that, his hang up?
Well, I think that Peterson's a pretty interesting guy in some senses, but he's a Gutenbergian figure.
Yeah.
So that if he were to encounter McLuhan, then he would find many things that he should think about and that would deepen his thought. And the amazing thing about Peterson not doing anything with McLuhan is that there are so many parallels between the two guys. I mean, they're both born in Alberta. They both taught briefly in the United States before they came back to the University of Toronto. They both taught at University of Toronto for decades. They both were viciously attacked by colleagues at Toronto. People were trying to throw both of them out.
And they both became figures at a tumultuous time.
Correct, and became world famous.
Yeah.
Right? So, and you could say they rode they surfed the networks that were available at the time.
Yeah, so, now let me tell you, I have thought of that much. Let me tell you how I laid it out a couple of years ago. The Electric Global Theater was making people more tribal. We're talking, I call it Madison Avenue McLuhan, cliche McLuhan, the popular image. So McLuhan, he becomes a figure from the Gutenberg galaxy who seems to be hip to the post-Gutenberg galaxy, and his image and the way he presents himself seems to be a guy who's not interested in books anymore, is defected from books, and is celebrating the the global theater, tribalism. Now, we know that that's nowhere near McClune, but that was the image of him. And so he was a necessary guide for the corporate establishment to help these old fuddy-duddies from World War II before to handle what was happening to their children and to society. He was a priest, a go-between, a mediator between the kids and the parents.
Yeah, okay. Could have been. Never was, but yeah, could have been.
A little bit at his best peak in 67, but that didn't last long because it was more complex what he was talking about. Okay, so McClellan's a literate guy who appears to be pro-tribal. So then along comes, so 50 years later, McClellan had predicted in 1970 in Cultures Are Business that we were going to flip into visual values again. As we move more into the tactile and the hyperkinetic, people have more and more nostalgia for visual values, and I would say that's McClellan predicting neoconservatism that came in with Reagan and the subsequent few decades. Okay, now the social media is having unforeseen effects, and it seemed to make people yearn for the Gutenberg or visual values that McClellan predicted, but it was more complex. So I said you had the exact opposite of McClellan. You had a tribal guy, Peterson. McClellan's literate, and he's putting on the tribal. Peterson is tribal, putting on the literate.
Correct.
Understanding the ground of literacy, but putting on the literate and meets a felt need for the visual values that supposedly men are yearning for, and the right hemisphere women have taken over and actually have put on the visual values and become aggressive and the whole complex stuff between the sexes. He's the exact opposite of McClellan going in the opposite direction. But the world has flipped away from McClellan, so that if McClellan showed up as himself now and Peterson would win because he was resonating with the present more than old McClellan would be if he was today. Do you know what I mean? It's a different situation.
Right. You mean resonating with the present as it conceives itself, not as it is.
Not the facts. Yeah, just the within
Absolutely.
The world of the facts.
Yeah.
So,
and, you know, you use the phrase, and then 50 years later, along comes Peterson. And what's interesting about that is McClellan was born in 1911, and Peterson was born in 1962. So when you say 50 years later, along comes Peterson, you could be talking about their births.
Right. Interesting. And, you know, 62 is a key year in McClellan's world.
Absolutely.
Okay, so what I just said, which I was thinking and talked about in interviews or in my radio show 2 or 3 years ago about Peterson, was based just on superficial seeing him on YouTube and interaction with people. I hadn't read any of his books. What struck me is he had the same situation as McClellan. People didn't know that McClellan was this heavy book guy and a revolution in literary theory and all that. They just thought he was a guy who thought TV was cool. But what I noticed in Peterson's lectures, he was a psychologist. He had a great knowledge of Gutenberg mythic encyclopediaism, you know, just all the traditional archetypes and humanist, classical humanism, which people didn't know about him. He was just a guy who would dare to argue with the students out in the schoolyard about their ridiculous confusion, quadrophenia, about what their bodies were. You know what I mean? What he was seeing, remember that YouTube, he's out arguing with the kids on the University of Toronto campus. With the fanatics, the social justice warriors. That's how he became known. That went viral. that YouTube.
Yeah.
And then you start to listen to some of his lectures, and you find out, you know, the guy was heavily Gutenberg. He had a good education and background in Jung and Freud and classical mythology and everything. So, again, he's exactly like McLuhan. People didn't know who they were dealing with or what was coming out of the university. And then Peterson gets sick like McLuhan.
Exactly. Exactly. And when, right? Peterson gets sick in 1919. And he's...
Not 1919, 2019.
I'm sorry, 2019, yeah. And so I believe, let's see, six...
McLuhan has a surgery in 67.
That's right. And so McLuhan at that time is 56, 57 years of age, right?
They're the same age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So so the result of Peterson's illness is described by his daughter as achasia,
which is like a
phasia. Inability. Yeah, but it's the inability to sit still, to come across to everybody as having the heebie-jeebies.
Would you say it's the inability to sit still?
Yeah, and to come across as having the heebie-jeebies.
Right?
That's what happened to McLuhan.
In what way? How was that McLuhan?
Yeah, that. So when Carpenter and Judith Fitzgerald as two describe what happened to McLuhan during the 60s when he was having his blackouts, his mini strokes and stuff. And then he had the severe one in 1960 when he was given the last rites. They say that McLuhan became an old man overnight, that he couldn't keep still, that people didn't recognize sort of the cool cucumber guy of the 50s anymore. And that's what happened to Peterson in 2019.
Right. So, okay. So when I became aware of Peterson and his lectures, and also it's a retrieval of the oral dialogue or long listenings. And people were almost nostalgic for the classroom and listening to a Northrop Frye or something go on and on and on. They were getting that on YouTube, you know, sit and listening to oral discourse.
Yeah.
So that's a little pre-tactile. It's a nostalgia.
Yeah, so it was a mixed message is always going on.
Yeah.
Because Peterson is definitely a Gutenbergian point of view, heroic, as he describes it, figure. But at the same time, he's always emphasizing dialogue, connection,
and emotion.
Tradition.
He's agonizing.
Yeah. So it's definitely a mixed message thing. And there again, that's part of his success.
Yeah, there's McLuhan, very cool and detached, puts fakes involvement and with it.
Correct.
And Peterson is a very emotional tribal guy faking literate detachment.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, so when I started to listen to him a bit, I said, oh, this guy doesn't know McLuhan. And so I was waiting for an opportunity to tell him about, you know, bump into him, email him or something. But what happened is somebody did it. He was being interviewed when he's well famous and in London and being interviewed all over the world just before he's ill. And he said in there somewhere, someone had brought up McLuhan. He said, yes, this has been drawn to my attention, been drawn to this. And I've looked at McLuhan, and I definitely, there's something there. I've got to take the time to look at more deeply. He admitted.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah. He admitted that it was something he needed to study a bit more. He recognized it was relevant, probably because he was getting this media massage in his fame. And he was probably looking at his user as content and a bit puzzled by the chaos around his image, the misinterpretation and the noise and the setups and the whole media battle of what McLuhan said, dancing on the other guy's toes. Man, did his toes get danced on. I think that he hadn't seen that coming, having been in the cloister classroom. And whatever people said McClellan was telling him, it resonated with that disservice that he had encountered, which probably made him sick. You know what I mean? So,
yes,
sir. The question now is...
Those are all good points.
What'd you say?
Those are all good points.
Thank you. And so somebody needs to call him up and say, did you do your McClellan yet? I mean, he got ill. He may not have been able to do it. He's supposedly recovered now, and he's got his own talk show or whatever. I never watch it, but I should watch and see if there's a way to just, you know, input, you know, send an email and say, did you do your McClellan homework? That needs to be asked of him.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
The what he says he wants to do is help to introduce a kind of revolutionary conceptuality that would help the world to a new understanding of itself. I think that's very important.
He sounds like you. He wants
well,
to do you.
Maybe.
Yeah, he would.
If you marry that to a Gutenbergian heroism and perspectivism,
yeah,
then it doesn't work.
Right.
And so you're absolutely right that what he needs to do is engage, I would say, not only McClellan, but Harold Innes.
That's right. And us.
And, yeah, but it's I at least don't have much connection to Toronto. You do.
Yeah.
But for Peterson to be talking all the time about the need to engage tradition, and that's a problem with the younger generation that they haven't done that. He hasn't engaged with the University of Toronto tradition.
That's right. And so
he needs to do that.
Yeah, and it would be very responsible if Bob Logan, De Kerckhoff, or any of those Toronto school guys that are around there, if they haven't told them this, they should notice this and tell them. You know
yeah.
what I mean? They should be pointing
yeah.
out the McClellan angle or encouraging him to look into it and ask him to talk about it, what homework he's doing. So, okay, so so we both notice the incredible mirror image reality. It's something unique about, you remember Don Thiel said the University of Toronto campus was unique. It created a guy like McClellan in the 50s because there were five colleges, five religions, and a very unique environment. I never thought the University of Toronto remained cool once McClellan was gone, but did it remain cool? Not cool McClellan was, it was just relevant. Why does it produce the next big guy? Do you know what I mean? That's what's interesting about the University of Toronto campus doing that.
Correct. Yeah, no, I think that's a side of Toronto that most people don't know much about, but having the Medieval Institute there, which is very heavy-duty scholarship, having a huge philosophy department, one of the best in the world, if not the best. These are, I don't know what you would call it, dynamic centers in Toronto that is generating intense insights far beyond themselves.
Right. So here's what you say gives me this pattern. Canada is a 19th century country. When McClellan's day, where he used to say that Canada had the advantage of being irrelevant to the 20th century, but right beside the big elephant, so we would watch America, and we'd have a philosophical detachment about it, and we'd contemplate the global theater. Okay, let's assume there's still a bit of that in Toronto. It's still old-fashioned, and so there's a bit of human scale at the University of Toronto that you wouldn't get in the big universities, the mega universities in the States, even though University of Toronto is a big population. But there's still the small-town Canadian aspect, and that allows a chemical body, human-scale guy to show up and interact with the students, which you probably wouldn't see in any campus in the United States. You just see riots or something, you know. It's more of mass tribalism. But it's the human scale of Canada and the University of Toronto, which makes it the ideal academic environment for a figure like McClellan or Peterson to be visible.
Maybe.
Yep, I'm going with that for now until you come up with something better. So all this
One thing to notice about them is that Peterson's book,
the
his
12
only
rules?
Book until
the 12 rules.
No, those are 12 rules. That's new stuff. He's written a couple books on that, but his original claim to fame is Maps of Meaning.
Oh yeah.
And first off, that gets back to the Cambridge English School.
Yeah.
And the whole idea that there is that you have to figure out the types of ambiguity in order to understand anything, right? So Peterson produces this book, but it's completely divorced from the considerations that are made in other disciplines, like English. Right? So he kind of takes up what McLuhan was doing his whole life, but completely ignoring McLuhan.
Right, and so the Cambridge background.
And the Cambridge background, and I mean, there's just, I could go on and on and on about what he ignores. But the amazing thing is that you have this idea of maps of meaning. And so McLuhan would say, well, the medium is the message. Therefore, you have to first define maps in order to have maps of meaning.
Yeah.
Right? If you haven't defined the map, then it's useless. And so Peterson, by not getting into this relevant background, did not understand sort of the crucial point that he himself was making.
Yes, he did.
Right? And so he made his whole career by kind of interjecting into very, very academic discussions in psychology about experiments with rats and experiments by taking mammals and cutting their spinal column in various places and really gruesome sort of stuff. Interjecting in that the whole world of myth, the whole world of Dostoevsky and Jung and Tolstoy and all that stuff. Not that Peterson understands these people with great acuity, but just that these topics, these themes, these subjects were completely unknown in his field. And so that he became, let's say by 20 years ago or something, he was the guru of mythology and of existentialism in the field of psychology.
Yeah. And that's the problem. He stayed too much in modern psychology. He doesn't know the classical ground of, say, Greek literacy of our psyche, where the psyche came
Correct.
From.
Yeah, this is absolutely true. And that's because although he talks about Plato and he talks about, Leibniz and Hegel and all this sort of stuff, what he hasn't done is pursued any of these people deeply enough to get into the real problems that they instigate. And because he hasn't done that, he's able to remain at the level of the Gutenbergian hero, which is just unfortunate.
And it's not going to work, and you'll get sick again.
Maybe. It'll work to make him fabulously wealthy. He'll become like Midas.
Right. Now, remember, his goal a couple of years ago was to create a new university. Remember that?
Correct. Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And in a way, McLuhan wanted to do that. And
Thiel
wanted to.
So
he's even putting on the McLuhan agenda or goal or somehow revitalize education. But it's pretty hard to do that today. In the media mix we're in. That's why, you know, when you were proposing to do that, you know, several months ago, I had to put you through a rigorous inquiry and investigation and what is the other one? Inquisition about what the hell you thought you were going to do.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty hard to do. I mean, he has, what is he now? He's a guy who has a YouTube talk show, right?
Well, I mean, no, it's far more than that. I mean, he's on YouTube, he's writing books, he's going around the world dialoguing with people. he's got, you know, tens of millions of followers 24 hours a day. So he has the attention, the wealth, and some of the motivations to actually accomplish some of the things that need to be accomplished.
Yeah, he is doing what you would have avoided doing, but with the same goal, but not to end up like him, what he's doing. So he's kind of making a mistake. So,
well, maybe we'll see.
Right, but
he
can't be successful without the McLuhanism.
That's right, but McLuhan himself, after 1960, he not only became recurrently ill, he also became fabulously famous, and it's not clear that his fame did him any good.
He even said, let's see, I found that in my archives. He admitted he had failed. I have a transcript of, in the letters this guy sent me, of him at the University of Toronto in February 69. So he's been a big deal, 66, 67, 68, and he's meeting with the president and Bissell and those guys, and they're trying to figure out what can we do with the student, the Bob Rays and the student radicals, and they want to do something about it and recognize it seriously, but they're at their wit's end about what to do. And McLuhan says in there, they bring up about, well, what we could do, which was sort of, I mean, we need a Jordan Peterson kind of thing. And in their terms back then. And McLuhan says, well, I already did it. And they all start laughing. That's right. And he said, it didn't work. He's saying it. It's like his inside private point of view to his buddies at the University of Toronto board level. So that's a really interesting confession that he's saying in 69. And then throughout 69 into 70, the media jumped on him, and he had to retreat. I mean, I talked to his brother Morris in about 70, 71, and he says, we're not going out there speaking anymore. We're sticking here in Toronto. We're just going to do it work locally. Now, he doesn't really start to go out there and be in the media again until 74 when Newsweek interviews him. And I remember saying, oh, McLuhan's back. He says that public transportation won't work because Americans go out to be alone. So that was his new insight, you know, that he was flogging in 73, 74. So he used it in his first return interview in Newsweek. Because he wasn't he wasn't in the popular media in 71, 72, 73. Mm-hmm. Maybe a couple of... What?
Well, there's two things I would say to that. I don't want to interrupt you, though, if you were...
Yeah, let me just finish that. So, okay. But he did a conscious media ecological posture of retreating from the media fame. And that's what he and Moore said they were doing in 71, 72, and he did that as much as he could. I think he got, that's also the time he got into fighting the Spadina Expressway. That was his local media ecology, so to speak. So then...
Let me just say that in 1970, he had already been very sick, of course, from his brain tumor.
Right.
1970, had a bad heart attack. And they discovered that his arteries were all screwed up in his neck.
Yes.
So he was a very sick man for a couple of years there at the start of the 70s.
Yes, 70 and 72. He had a crisis in 76. He had three problems. You know, he had to be hospitalized.
Correct. Well, just on and on and on, sure.
Yeah.
But he, at least in the early 70s, he was in no physical shape to really engage with the media.
Yeah, so that may be a reason why he did retreat. That's another private reason. He didn't have the energy to do it.
Correct. But when you say that he then reappeared in around 74, and his new message was Americans go out to be alone, this is actually a new formulation of a thought that he had always had. Because what McLuhan means by going out to be alone isn't, you know, physically walking into a restaurant with your date and you're alone or something. What he means is the persona that's put on by people to go out into the world is not subject to correction by others. It's
by your, what? By your, others, did
by
you say?
By others.
Yeah.
Other people.
Right.
It's in other words, it's forcible. It's something that is not related to tradition. It's not related to the environment. It's Americans go out to be alone. That is, they're forcing their persona on everything else, including on their own selves. And you could say that this is what has become of the world. America has introduced that way of being a self everywhere. And as you were saying earlier in our conversation today, that necessarily dissolves all other cultures.
Right.
It's a kind of acid. And to get back to Peterson, the great contradiction in what he's trying to do is he's trying to produce very communitarian goals using precisely this acid. And it'll never work if he doesn't see how he has to let the acid, instead of using the acid, he has to let the acid dissolve himself, and then he would be able to reemerge in a way that it would enable a success of his communitarian goals.
Right. Now, let me say that when you read McLuhan's writings in the Borderline case about going out to be alone, it's environmental. Americans come to this wilderness, and they've got to tame it. They're coming from Europe, where the land has been tamed for thousands of years. It's pastoral and agricultural and all that. You don't get that in America, so you go out to be alone is a response to the environment. It's hostile, and you go home to be social, whereas in Europe, you go home to be alone. So I don't know why you said it didn't. Your words didn't seem to go with what I'm saying, that it was.
Well, remember that when you say that nature is hostile, that itself is a perception.
Yes, that's a literate perception that they bring, but they didn't have the oral, pastoral, wonderful Europe that tourism serves in this new wilderness. It was exciting in a new way, but you had to be aggressive with it. You had to, you know, slice through the foliage. You had to encounter the first natives and all that. So it was a so you became an aggressive person socially outside of your home, but you went home to be social, and the warmth of the kitchen and the social hearth. So he points out that the first Canadian school of painters, the group of seven, they make paintings with no humans in them. They're showing the hostile environment or romanticizing it, whatever. But it's important that, and McLuhan said this, that their art that becomes archetypal Canadian art shows the landscape that that Margaret Atwood laid out. Remember, he got his insight from Margaret Atwood in her survival book.
I mean, he definitely read survival on many occasions, but
he realized she didn't know that the pattern was people going out alone, but the way she described Canadian literature, the going out to be alone was what he got out of it. She stimulated
him. But at least to my way of thinking, this idea, which I admit McLuhan talked about many times, of sort of the harsh, inhuman Canadian environment.
Yeah.
To me, there's something wrong there. There's something.
Okay, so let's clarify that. That's why, because what you were saying was something different from what I understood he would say in his explaining about going out to be alone, why Americans did that.
Correct.
You're saying something else about the individual imposing something? What are you saying there?
Their persona. I'm saying going out is what human beings do. When they speak or when they look, even when they hear, when they feel, this is a going out, right? And the whole existence of a person is going out.
Oh, that's uttering. That's uttering is outering.
Correct.
Yeah.
So then the great question is does that uttering take place in a communal environment, or does it impose itself on a environment that is beheld as difficult and wild and barbaric because of the imposition, right? If you didn't have to impose, then the environment wouldn't be barbaric. So the great question is, where did these perceptions of the environment, where do these notions of uttering come from? And McLuhan's answer to that was media.
Yeah.
So if we are to believe what you were saying about McLuhan's view, namely, you have a wild environment that's sort of a given, and then people react to that.
Literate people.
Sorry?
Literate people react in a certain way.
Correct. So, in other words, that environment, even in its most extreme, way above the Arctic Circle, as long as you have a society that knows what it's doing, then the environment can be lived in. And so you have the Eskimos, and then you have the different Athabascan peoples, and then you have the Métis, and the environment, it can be perfectly social, but it all depends on the media through which that environment is processed.
Right. So the American, the European comes to America, he's got the literate bias. He's not aware that his literate bias will make him perceive the external, the outside as hostile.
Correct.
Yeah. Whereas the acoustic tactile natives, they don't have that problem.
Correct.
Right. Okay, so you get this literate effect, and it's like the literate European background is put on the moon, which is North America. It has a whole different response. But it does explain a lot of American bias, as shown in the Henry James novels. When Daisy Miller goes to Europe, she's the American that goes out to be alone. So she's very aggressive and upsets the aristocratic going out to be social. And did you ever see McLuhan talking about the role of the mistress in America versus Europe? So you know that point. That's very interesting. The mistress is isolated in America. They can't be taken into the home. They can't enjoy social life in the kitchen. So they're always isolated in their apartment waiting for the guy to marry them so that they can be social. But if they don't, they have a pretty sad situation. They're isolated. They can only go out and be alone when they go out, and no social life, really. The European mistress has a grand time out in society, but does not get to have the advantage of going home to be alone, which the wife has in European society. So it's a very interesting pattern that he made, and it's enlightening. You tell people about the difference between the American mistress and the European mistress.
Right.
The European mistress doesn't have the isolation that Americans do.
And correct. So then the... But it, The question is, what's being talked about in all of this? There's the literal level. Well, there's, you know, he's talking about the mistress and he's talking about the frontier and all this sort of stuff. But I think he's mostly talking about self-image and its relationship with meditation. So when the European goes home to be alone, what does that mean? I mean, aren't there people in the house? Don't they invite people over?
No, they don't.
In Europe, but come on, they do.
I know, but McLuhan took that trend. He said, you'll never get invited home by a European. No, that's not true.
That's it is true in England, right?
Yeah, in certain parts of Europe, it's a bit of a difference from North America. It's like he says, he does a satire on the surface manners of life. These are surface things.
That's right.
Yeah.
But you know, the subtopic of almost everything we've said in our conversation today is tactility.
Yeah.
So when McLuhan is talking about mistresses and going home or not going home and all that sort of stuff, he's always talking about something else at the same time because that's what the tactile or the electric is this multiplicity of levels, of poles that can't be avoided. So when McLuhan talked about learning stuff from his talk, partly that was because when he was talking about something, he was also talking about something else. He didn't know it at the time, but after he had talked about it, he could see it.
Yeah, he could see the effect. Right? I have an example of that. When he died, the famous guy who ran Rampart's magazine knew McLuhan in the 60s, and he talks about some of the dinners and stuff, conversations, and he said, one time he and maybe Howard Gossage and a bunch of them are having dinner, and one of them started to complain about McLuhan always harping on Figure Ground or the media. The guy in his obituary memories is saying McLuhan shocked everybody. He said, McLuhan responded, he says, well, that's what I meant when I didn't say it. And I've used that when people say, well, you're leaving out the whole advertising commercial, blah, blah. I said, well, that's what I meant when I didn't say it. You know, it's a great line, but that's what that's confirming what you're saying.
Yeah.
There were other things he's noticing that he can't talk about at the same time.
Correct. Or he didn't even know that he was talking about them. Yeah. Yeah.
Right, so he'd get the, like he said, I didn't know what I thought until after I'd said it. So hyper-awareness of himself, and maybe they call that self-reflexivity in postmodernism.
Maybe, but that it works for me. That's a good word.
Yeah.
Or a good phrase, perhaps.
Right, so, so we've illustrated the multi-level point of McLuhan, which nobody points out, in his communication methodology. You know, to say that he's studying the medium as he's doing it, that's too literal, too mundane of what he's actually doing when he's engaging in conversation or interacting with audiences.
Correct.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah. And it's the great problem that we have here can be put in terms of what we were saying earlier about Peterson. Peterson's hero thinks that what he does is engage uncertainty, and in uncertainty he sees a range of possibilities, and the hero, unlike your citizen who's a banker or a newspaper man or something like that, your hero engages with the different possibilities and then re-energizes society by coming back with a new possibility.
Yeah.
So what's wrong with this prescription is that the ability to see the level of possibilities and the ability to see different possibilities in that level are not given like a tree is given. that it requires a certain type of perception. But the problem is that that certain type of perception is itself a possibility. So in order to see the level of possibilities, you have to have already seen it.
Yeah.
And there's this not K-N-O-T in time, which reconfigures the hero. The hero cannot go into the realm of possibilities as the hero and then sort things out there and then come back. The hero has to lose herself completely in order to have these perceptions of possibility.
Yeah. Carry on. I'm looking up a quote, but carry on.
Yeah, yeah. So in what we're talking about, the what's interesting about McLuhan trying to engage people about multi-levels, as you were just saying, is that multi-levels cannot be pointed out, like there's a refrigerator over there, and over there there's a dog, right? There's a kind of somersault that is required to engage with these things. And absent the somersault, then everything is going to be literal. So the great riddle that now faces the world is how do we get out of the literal into the a world of potentiality without destroying ourselves?
Right. So I go to this quote when you're talking about, I'll read the quote, and it'll remind me of what you were saying. Mm-hmm. This is Cliched Archetype, page 163. Like Alice, Joyce pushed all the way through the narcissist looking glass.
Uh-huh.
That's the hero. He moved from the private Stephen Dedalus to the Finnegan corporate image. The mirror, like the mind, by taking in and feeding back the same image, becomes a wheel, a cycle, able to retrieve all experience. So Ulysses is about the hero, Joyce's Ulysses, and then Finnegan's Wake is the dissolved Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, the dissolved hero. So,
mm-hmm. Although Ulysses, of course, has Bloom, and so it's kind of the dialogue between the hero and the anti-hero.
Yeah, but the point is, it's still dealing with the individual, the Gutenberg individual, the tribal, the dissolved situation you were describing there that Peterson hasn't gone through yet is the meaning of Finnegan's Wake, or the demonstration of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I just wanted to mention that great quote, how that fits here. Let's see. Where are we? How are we doing?
Well, we were just about to get into the tech body's interview with anybody that gives short questions and answers. It's basically the end of the book. But before we get into that, read that quotation from Cliched Archetype one more time.
Okay.
Because that is, I mean, you're absolutely right. That is such an important quote that it can hardly be overemphasized.
All right. And I'll read the second one from the same page. So this is 163 from Cliched Archetype. Like Alice, or like Lewis Carroll, like Alice, Joyce pushed all the way through the narcissist looking glass. He moved from the private Stephen Dedalus to the Finnegan corporate image. The mirror, like the mind, by taking in and feeding back the same image, becomes a wheel, a cycle, able to retrieve all experience. Then later on that page, he says, the whole of Finnegan's Wake, including the title, is paradox. Based on what Joyce considered man's greatest invention, the mirror of language, the magazine wall of memory and all human residue.
Yep.
So, 163 for those important quotes. Okay, so we go back to, but I'm wondering how, on the time, we've done 2 hours.
Yeah.
Is it, so it is 7:10. You can go till 7:30, right?
Let's say, sure.
Yeah. Okay, so I think this was a round, long explanation of the tech body talking about itself, or I am talking about the tech body, where, look at this, the tech body captured the printing press, print type, type, printing type, print type. There's no printing press anymore. There are no presses. Then he quotes, stop the presses. There are no presses anymore. The tech body took them all over. It obfuscated it. It's like a rotary phone. They got captured. They've disappeared and been captured by the tech body. The reason you don't see it is because of the tech body. So the tech body has everyone. It's been taken over. Now, that implies the tech body's been taken over in the grammar, but the world has been taken over. The tech body decides.
Yeah.
So
I
then
think that the sentence means it's all been taken over.
Yes. Yeah. And Ayn is always explaining how much the tech body's taken over. This documentary, The Social Dilemma, did you see that?
No. You've referred to it several times, so maybe I should see it one day.
Oh, yeah, because they've got the hero is a media ecologist, Gutenberg and media ecologist, and what he's trying to do. And he even got funding to set up an institute to do what you wanted to do. he got there first because he was part of this Silicon Valley world. So this movie is very good to show the figure of what they're missing. It's like another version of Peterson. They get very close, and they try to say what people fantasize of technology taking us over, what we're worried is going to happen, and they'll replace and dump humans. He says, this guy, that that's already happened. And I agree. It's further along than people realize.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you're saying
sure,
that,
of course.
Too.
Yeah.
So it's been taken over. The tech body decides. So anybody, the little man says, hey, tech body, is the tech body a physical machine? Tech body says, no. Anybody, is the tech body a construct of somebody's mind? Tech body says, we don't know quite what you mean, but the answer would be yes. If you can picture your words as something over the game, watching the game, controlling the game, deciding what moves are next for individual players that should have their own free will, but they don't. That's quite a sentence. That's kind of knowing through words, McLuhan's humanist aspect. If you have the right word, you can control it. And so Peterson doesn't have the right words. McLuhan felt he had the right words, and it was almost a science, his words. So the tech body's agreeing with McLuhan. We don't quite know what you mean, us as a construct of somebody's mind, but the answer would be yes. If you can picture your words as something over the game, watching the game. Remember, in understanding media, the games are the only media that has the same definition as the title, extensions of man. So media are games. So your words are something over the game, watching the game, controlling the game, deciding what moves are next for individual players that should have their own free will, but they don't. Which reminds me that this individual going out to be alone thing, one time, and I quote it in the essay here, he's in California about 1970, and he says that the private individual is something from way back, before tribalism, before caveman, so to speak, or Neanderthal caveman was this private individual, and he says it got retrieved by the Gutenberg world. You don't. He never says that anywhere else. He says the Gutenberg world.
Yeah, that's
world
a very weird thing. I don't know what to make of that myself.
Well, I got a lot to say about that, but you remember me bringing up that quote before?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well,
I didn't understand it then, and I don't understand it now.
Okay, imagine before there was socialization, whether humans were cavemen or half animal or something, but let's say they're not socialized in any way. They can't speak. They live in the world of verbum. McLuhan's tetrad on verbum is pretty good. It reminds me of Zappa's movie script he had in the 60s. Captain Beefheart meets the grunt people. So you got this grunting going on. They don't have language yet. Remember that movie of early man that Trudeau liked and promoted back about 1980? Quest for Fire. You ever see that?
No.
Okay, they have some interesting scenes of early humans. Okay, so early humans are not socialized. They're by themselves, wandering around, maybe with one other person, if that. That is the ancient isolation that we've arrived at today.
Well, but there was, I mean, if we're talking in terms of fact, there never was such a quote-unquote human, right? That's,
well, maybe there was, but in normal knowledge, no. But see, that's why you don't understand it. I mean, McLuhan dared think, well, maybe before we were socialized, before there was speech, there was these hypersensitive individuals, sort of like Sasquatches or those kind of characters. Well, what's the other
one? McLuhan often said that it's language that defines humans.
And yeah.
That there's no humans before language, et cetera. But also you have to think about how humans get born. I mean, you do need a man and a woman to do that. And then the child can't be just left in a pile of shit somewhere.
That's
right. The
child
needs to be cared for. So humans, aside from language and aside from socialization, are not thinkable.
Okay, so now that's where Ayn comes in. Ayn says that humans aren't born. They're eternal. They never had a beginning point. Okay, now, granted, who's going to believe that? Nobody. But Ayn says, and so I thought about that idea. We exist before, the whole thing of being birthed is an illusion. And Ayn says there's no such thing as reincarnation. You're already coronated, and you don't get re-coronated. Uh-huh. So that weird scenario that Ayn talks about helped me project into McLuhan's idea that there was a private individual or an eternal individual at the very beginning. So that's one way.
Well, there's a big difference. There's a big difference between humans having at least an aspect of themselves that's eternal, and imagining that there's quote unquote humans wandering around in some part of Africa that didn't get born and didn't have language.
I know it sounds a little preposterous, but
it does.
I'm not afraid to include it as a scenario, especially when I got Ion, who waxes eloquent a lot of details about it.
Yeah. This is in my opinion, this is the great thing about your mind is that number one, you're not afraid to say things. And number two, the things that you say very often come across as ridiculous or
insane.
if you think about what you're saying, I mean, if other people on hearing you think about it and really think about it, then very often it's profound. And as we were saying earlier with McLuhan, it doesn't have anything to do with you were.
Say it again. It doesn't have anything to do with what?
With what you're intending to say.
Yes.
And that's because intention is localized to one or maybe two levels or something.
Yeah.
People speak profoundly. They're speaking in multi-levels. And in order to think about what they're saying, is you have to understand those levels.
Yes.
And so
I'm good at that.
You're very good at that. And amongst the things that are in the levels below the literal level of what you're saying, is that there's a very close attention to McLuhan and to other people. So that, for example, when you quote cliched archetype, as you did a few minutes ago from 163, people should appreciate that this is not something that quote-unquote normal people can do. It takes takes extraordinary mind to be able to do that.
Good memory.
Well, more than that. It's more than that. Because you need to be able, it's not just a memory, it's a question of knowing which passages are particularly pregnant, understanding the relationship to other passages, and being able to reproduce these things in a fashion that demands thought. Those are all qualities beyond memory.
Very good. Yeah, it's like knowing when to retrieve the thing at the right time in a figure ground resonance.
Yeah.
Yeah, I find that's generally how my mind works. Carolyn does it in medicine. Someone will ask a question she hasn't thought about in medical terms for decades, but the answer pops up right away in her mind, and she hadn't thought of that answer in a long time. I seem to be able to do that with McLuhan. And not thinking about quotes, not engaging it, and then talking to you, the quotes pop into my mind because they've become part of me, but I'm not thinking about them all the time. But they're ready to be used, which would be the rhetorical ideal. That's the rhetorician has that ability. So, well, I'm glad you appreciate that. It's rare for someone not to flip out about it. Tell me to go home. Go home and be alone again. So that's quite a paragraph there. And then so he's saying the players, individual players, that should have their own free will, but they don't. Then anybody says that implies there's some godlike, take what he goes, power. And I go, something that is, or anybody does, something that is. And then the tech body says power again. Then I go, the tech body. So I start to say the tech body is power. Let's see. I say
that's what the tech body goes on to say immediately.
Right. That implies there's some godlike, it says, it, power, us. And I go, that's something like the tech body. So we're converged, conflating there. Then you mean the next paragraph where he goes, power.
Yeah.
It's your power. It's your human power. That's a good phrase. That's extensions of humans. All technology are extensions of the human powers. It's your power that you separated yourself from because you didn't use what Marshall McLuhan said. Quote, you're ridiculous, and you don't know what you're doing, and you're doing it anyway, and you think you're watching TV, but the TV's watching you, unquote. So anybody,
One thing that I find particularly interesting in this passage here is that in Nietzsche's later career, he came to see everything in terms of the will to power.
Yes.
And our conversation has often gone to Nietzsche's nihilism. And to how that nihilism was a kind of cul-de-sac that the modern world has become ensnared in. And a part of that whole context, that whole picture, is power.
Yeah.
Is the idea that it's very hard to get around the notion that everything is expression as power, expression that will that is intended to shape, not expression that is part of some sort of dialogue.
Right. So that's being numb. You have your powers, and you're unaware of your powers and how it's shaping you. You need to have the tactile conversation to become aware of the misuse of your powers.
Correct.
Something like that.
Stunting of your powers.
Yeah. So I'm there trying to keep up with the tech body, so I go, so that, and the tech body won't let me finish my sentence. It goes, now, we're going to decide what you watch. And I go, exactly what you have said, that we've given up our power to do those things. Tech body goes, yeah. And I finish the sentence, do those things to something else. Tech body says, correct. Then I go, so that's something else, Tech Body interrupts. Now, the powerful humans are left to drive this new Tech Body that's very powerful, very powerful. And then I go, if it's not a physical machine, what is it? Power. And who is wielding the power if we aren't? Tech Body, yes, the humans sacrifice or separate themselves from their power because they wanted something smarter than they to than they. They wanted something smarter than they to run the ship. And so they got it. They asked for it, and they got it. So the humans created the Tech Body, and they continue. Now, artificial intelligence, which isn't very artificial anymore, makes its own artificial intelligence. It can run every potential outcome. It takes all probability out of the conversation.
Right. So that's, I noticed something smarter than they to run the ship. What runs the ship is the captain, the cybernetes, and so that's cybernetics.
Yeah.
And then taking probability out of the conversation is sort of the motor of cybernetics. So they cybernetics isn't mentioned in the paragraph literally, but it's all about cybernetics.
Right, and the Tech Body enhances, extends, squares that, and it's now taking over. We're losing whatever power we could have taken advantage of. Basically, the Tech Body, you know, humans are extending themselves and getting incredible power just with their smartphones. But they're totally ridiculous in relation to it. They don't understand the implications of it, what happens to tradition and everything. So so because humans are misusing, unaware of the power that's been dumped on them, by default, with the new extensions, they become giants and don't realize it, the Tech Body takes hijacks it and takes it over. And that's what the Tech Body Ion says. It wants us to get more and more powerful and be unaware that we have become more powerful, and then it sucks it away from us. That's what he's trying to say here. I mean, I know that from later conversations, but mm-hmm. I didn't know what was being said here too much as it first happened, because this is the first talk with the Tech Body. So let's leave it at that. It's complex. We need to take a break, think about what the hell we've learned here,
yeah.
what we've done to ourselves, and come back next week.
That's right. And one question that we've mentioned in the past, and which I think this whole section raises again, is that we need to understand how the anthropomorphic physical relates to this.
Yes.
And how it's the same or different. And maybe that's something that we can discuss next week when we come to the end of this interview.
Yeah, that we do the interview, finish the interview, then do that, the AP.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, good. And I'll make a note on that. And we'll also do the technique of suspended judgment that you wanted to do today. So
we can
bring that up. Because I just wanted to get more of this interview done. I'm happy with what we've got done. We've got a good chunk of it, and then so we can do the technique of suspended judgment. Okay, so
good. That's
very good. Thanks a lot, Cameron.
And thank you, Bob.
Glad you're feeling
good
better.
Good to talk to you.
Right, yes, very good.
Appreciate it.
All right, talk to you later.
Okay,
bye-bye. Bye.